I'm Bruce Levin. Boris invited me, and probably because he doesn't know the difference between small biologists and microbiologists. And I'm an evolutionary biologist who works with bacteria. And then I thought about it. Maybe the real reason is because I'm old, and he thinks I'm a contemporary of Pasteur and Darwin. Well, actually, there is a lot of truth in that. In fact, I spent a fair amount of time with both of them. I actually told Louis that if he starts speaking a modern language, he would probably, have a good career. But he didn't listen. And as far as Darwin, I mentioned, that he ought to start working with bacteria. Then he would have a lot of influence, but really he didn't listen either. And maybe you shouldn't listen either. So, this is a hard lecture for me to prepare because I'm not quite sure. I know you're a very diverse group, and I don't know what your background is. And I have a particular perspective on microbiology. I never took a course in microbiology, although I teach a course in microbiology, but that's at an undergraduate level. It's a good way to learn microbiology. Teaching is really a good thing that way. My hearing is not very good, so speak up. I do want to hear what you say, and I'm hoping there will be discussion. I'll try and say things that are more or less provocative. I won't talk much about bacteria as a model system for studying evolution. You're in the best place for it. The people that will be coming here are the ones that are really where it's happening in this field. I did give my daughter advice, though. My daughter's a microbiologist, and the only advice she ever took, and that is, eukaryotes are great to sleep with, but you don't want to do research on them. So that's a tremendous bias. But that doesn't account for yeast. Yeast probably, I don't know, but we probably sleep with them anyhow. In any event, so I started with Drosophila, but I've only, most of my career when I was an assistant professor, I switched to bacteria, and I never turned back because of what one can do, the fact that you can control things so terribly well. And you could look at evolution in real time. There's this wonderful essay. I've started a Dropbox file for this group, and I will keep putting stuff in there. You can throw it out, including our couple of classical. There's a book written in 1926 by de Kuff called The Microbe Hunters. And if you really, it's a bit romantic, it's sexist, and all of that. But if you really want to get a good view of the history of microbiology, it's told at a very, personal level. Of course, the women were always helping the men out. Mrs. Koch bought Robert a microscope, which started his career. Then, of course, he took off with an opera singer later on in life. But that's another matter. The book is great. I really recommend it, and I do it for my students. This is something written now, I realize it's 20 years ago, in theory. I hope you're reading it. Because it's sort of, this is Sidney Brenner, who you probably know as C. elegans and so on. And he won the Nobel Prize for the C. elegans work. But his really great work, I think, was showing that the stop codons were the stop codons, and that was a really elegant experiment. So, what I like most about microbiology is in fact, the elegance of the experiments. And so, if you read in molecular biology, it's been the great leveler and has made thinking unnecessary in many areas of modern biology. And the absence of this decline in hypothesis-driven research. The term I love is data-driven, meaning if you're going to look at enough of those data, you're going to get something out of it. Maybe. I think you're getting observations. And then I love the end. It's sort of that is you that the asking questions and thinking about how cells really is likely to be a source of irritating delay to the managerial classes and could even hurt your career. It's very, very cynical, and it's also very nostalgic, and I agree with all of it. I just want you to, it'd be fun, to, you'll enjoy it. Then there's some recognized prejudices, which I will answer to. First of all, I think it's important for the, and this is not an audience that it's an issue with, that is doing evolutionary biology without models. And simulations, it's like playing tennis without a net or boundary lines. We really need the theory. The data may be a crutch for the insecure, but really self-confident scientists test the hypotheses or subject them to tests that can reject them. Just because a project is useful doesn't mean it isn't high quality and delicious science. And that is much of what, you know, I guess I had a career crisis when I realized I wasn't going to be a bluegrass superstar. And I began to work on things that were useful in about mid-career and doing work on antibiotics. It's kind of, you feel righteous. And Paul knows all about how important it is to feel righteous. And for us, natural and not-so-natural selection is all about DNDT, not DNDS. That is, we're interested in the mechanisms of evolution, not, I believe in evolution, my whole family does, so really want to get at the mechanisms. And then the other thing is all models and model systems are wrong, some are useful, and that's by, and then I also believe models are more useful when they don't fit. That means you've got something, you know, if the model fits, you stop under the assumption that you've got it. If the model doesn't fit, that means your assumptions are wrong. Okay, I thought it'd be useful to give a kind of historical perspective on things, and I may part because to deal with the diversity. And this, the Microbe Hunters, there's two books. I gave you the Microbe Hunters, and I also gave you a book called Milestones in Microbiology, which are the original articles of these people, going back to Jenner and so on. And I really think they're worth reading. There's some great stuff in there. You know, you think of Jenner as a sort of country doctor. These guys were really thinking deeply, and their articles are really worth reading. And so that's in your, and Spalzani was really one of the first, Leeuwenhoek would write these letters to the Royal Society with pictures of microbes, and he wouldn't tell anybody how he made his microscopes and things like that, but they weren't very good, and then he would have to draw these pictures. But he essentially opened the world to the fact that there were things that we cannot see with the naked eye. And then there was a series of people basically presenting evidence for contagion. Jenner, Semmelweis. Semmelweis, you may not know, he was a physician in Vienna and in Budapest working in a maternity hospital. And the mortality rate from childbed fever, group A strep, was about as high as 18% in the wards. I mean, just think about that. You're a young woman, and you're pregnant, and there's an 18% chance of dying during childbirth. And he was working there, and he made the observation that the physicians were not washing their hands. Why would you wash your hands? There was no germ theory. And they were going into the postmortems and then doing it, whereas the midwives were having much lower rate of mortality. And he made the inference about contagion. Snow, of course, you know, did it with cholera. And Lister was one carbolic acid and got surgery, all of which suggested that there was contagion. At the time, people believed there was a miasma. I mean, the world smelled like shit anyhow, so you probably thought that was in fact the cause, and it seemed very reasonable to assume that was the cause. And as you know, John Snow showed with the cholera map in Soho, where that famous pump is right in Soho in London. That's where it's located, the one showing that cholera was in fact transmitted in the waters. So this is in the 1850s. It's sort of interesting, and I'm not much of a scholar, but with MS Word you can scan all literature. And I found this wonderful quote a number of years ago from Darwin. And so this is in 1868. A particle of small parts matter so minute to be borne by the wind must multiply itself many thousandfold in a person inoculated, and so with it the contagious matter of scarlet fever. Here's Darwin really talking about infectious disease. But if you go a little bit further and scan a little bit further, he doesn't mention it as a selective force. There's a footnote. This is in Animals and Plants Under Domestication. There's a footnote where he talks about diseases and vices as possible selective forces. In other words, what he was interested in this particular passage, he was arguing for these gemmules, that is, that in hereditary material, he had this idea that there were these very small particles that come from every cell and and end up in the sperm and ova, and that's how it's called the hypothesis of pangenesis. And he was criticized by saying, how can these things be so small that every cell in the body would then have these things which would then germinate, cause gemmules. He was using infectious disease as an argument for these being so small. He wasn't at all interested in disease. It's really kind of a fascinating passage. But anyways, the implication was contagion was already there. People knew about transmission and were making inferences. But the real thing got started, as we know it, with Louis Pasteur, who was basically showing, spontaneous generation. But Louis Pasteur was a chemist, and then he got into fermentation and arguing that fermentation involved microbes and rotting involved microbes. And that was a big revelation. People have been making wine for centuries and centuries and centuries, and beer and so on. But putting it together, and there was a controversy in the early 19th century about whether living organisms were involved in this. And so, I mean, all of that was done long before the theory. And then, of course, Robert Koch was really, in terms of the origin of contemporary microbiology and how we work, Koch was a great deal of influence, because Koch believed in getting pure cultures of microbes. And then von Behring and Roux. Von Behring was won the first Nobel Prize and before Koch, who was his advisor. Koch was involved in a scandal about tuberculosis. He announced he had a cure. It's kind of fascinating. I could put those articles in there too. So he announced he had a cure for tuberculosis, and this is at a time tuberculosis was killing about 200 per 100 or more in the middle of night, about 300-400, about twice the rate of killing of cancer. And somebody makes an announcement he has a cure for tuberculosis. It was really hot stuff. Would have been all over the internet had he had a Facebook page. But anyways, he didn't have a cure. He was using tuberculin. He wasn't going to admit what it was. So there was a big scandal with Koch, and it's kind of fun to read. And so von Behring and Roux were important in another way. They were the first ones to talk about the mechanisms by which microbes cause disease. What Koch and the others were doing was showing the relationship, but we're not getting at mechanisms. And so they were important, and they were also the first therapy, antitoxins, and so on. And then Paul Ehrlich, there's two Paul Ehrlichs, there's a more recent one at Stanford, an ecologist. In case you're wondering if it's the same one. Paul Ehrlich was important in terms of not only in immunology, the first chemotherapy, an antimicrobial chemotherapy for treating syphilis. and also just a very important microbiologist. And so much of the origins of microbiology as we know it were these people. And there were basically two levels, one of which is fermentation and food preparation. There was a great deal, and there still is a great deal of interest in microbes and infectious disease. You know, and I was going to, a suggestion of with this whole question of trying to concern about emerging infectious diseases. And I went to a meeting and everybody's worried about emerging infectious diseases and what to do. But it was sort of obvious, you know, you build a wall. I mean, a huge wall. And not only that, you can get microbes to pay for it because they're working for industry. I mean, but I don't think the suggestion got very far, but maybe I've got to send it up to Washington and get it there. In any event, there's this wonderful comment by Michael Pollan, if it doesn't rot, don't eat it. We're very concerned about, you know, if you look at a Twinkie, you know, you can't figure out its age, maybe by DNA data you can. In any event, so the food microbiology remains important. And infectious disease microbiology is really, if you look at most of what contemporary microbiologists are doing, many of them, or I don't know, is working on some aspect of infectious disease. And Stanley Falco is my hero in very, very many ways. And more than anybody else, he's tremendously influenced this whole approach to infectious disease, which I think is a little bit kind of limited, but not because of Stanley. I mean, many of them just think you get this virulence determinant and sort of frustrated lambda geneticists trying to work on infectious disease without looking at the whole. So the question about how microbes cause disease is, in fact, a major area of contemporary biology. That is, how these things determine cause disease. And it's sort of really interesting evolutionarily, that is to say, the various ideas about infectious disease. Why does a dog bite the hand that feeds it is another way of phrasing it. There's a conventional wisdom. When I was a student, we were taught that disease was a primitive association and everything was evolving in the direction of niceness, symbiosis, and commensalism. And that if you had an infection, it was sort of something primitive relationship. And Bob May used the word conventional wisdom, which is taken from a wonderful economist, Kenneth Galbraith. That's sort of what people were trained in. And if you ask people then, maybe even if you ask them now, they'll tell you it's an odd thing rather than an evolved thing. And then there's a whole trade-off things. That is, I could go through this history, that is, virulence is a way necessary for transmission. And everybody goes back to the myxoma story, and you wonder if they all give you the same story, how come, why couldn't there be more stories like that? And there's a lot of interest in it. Coincidental evolution is one of my favorites. It's sort of shit happens. That is to say, it's really not the evolved, virulence is not the evolved character. And then along with Jim Bull a number of years ago, we simply suggested the possibility of short-sighted evolution. That is, the microbe in the host really doesn't know, have any sense, so that it's a selective advantage within the host, but collectively a disadvantage. I think one of the polio would be a good example of that, the polio virus. Polio virus is fecal oral. It's an enteric virus. And it was a common enteric virus. And then why does it cause, it gets into the central nervous system, a total dead end for the virus. Same thing's true with meningitis and so on. Why do they cause disease? Well, could be shit happens. And it could also be within host evolution. And that's one of the concerns with, say, the polio vaccine. That is, it evolves and can generate virulence. It's also interesting as a case of a disease of sanitation, that people would be infected continuously early in life, maternal protection, and then we cleaned up the environment, and all of a sudden poliomyelitis became a disease because people were being infected later. And this, the other thing is that is most of the virulence is really a consequence of host screwing up, which is a really interesting phenomenon. And I suggest that in the long, that our immune system, we've written a paper about it. I'll put it into the site. This is with a wonderful MD PhD student, Ellie Margolis. We wrote this a paper on summarizing these ideas, not our own ideas, but and that, you know, that is to say, if you take sepsis and most diseases, when the actual symptoms are a consequence of screwing up, rather. And I suspect in the long-term future, we're going to try and control the innate and adaptive immune system to prevent this from happening. So right now, we're sort of in this early post-Pasteur thing, kill the microbe rather than address this other thing. It raises some really interesting questions about how to do it. And we've been totally, virtually unsuccessful in, say, controlling sepsis and things like that. Sepsis being a host response to bacterial lipopolysaccharides and things. I'm not going to say much more about it, but it is an area of considerable focus and an area of considerable interest, and ones that has evolutionary and population dynamic things, because we're looking at population dynamics both in the microbe, and we're also looking at population dynamics with respect to the host response. I'm going to make these PowerPoints available so that you can do with them what you want. And so much of early microbiology was naming names, like taxonomy became really, really important. And, you know, you wanted to name names. And so, first of all, they developed methods to culture bacteria in vitro, which was a lot of effort, and particularly focusing on pathogens. That is to say, so that the early work, we're focused on pathogens. And when you look at classification, the pathogens are overclassified and the commensals are poorly classified. I mean, it was sort of, you know, so the Salmonella, for example, there was typhi and typhimurium and so on. All of them had different names, whereas E. coli really was not. So they owe this emphasis. And for organisms that were not excessively fastidious. And whether we're going to be able to culture more, I forgot what fraction we can culture. But now people are going to give that up, because why culture when you can sequence? And this is the kind of thing people used to learn, that is, you would take a bacterium and then have this test and see basically what it ate, what it was capable of fermenting, and from that you would decide on what it is. So it was morphological and so on. And central to that was Gram stain for most bacteria, mycobacterium, doesn't fit in that. Mycoplasm don't fit, but many do fit. So it's either Gram positive or Gram negative. If I get some new bacteria in the lab and I don't know what it is, the first thing I'll do is a Gram stain, and that's often the last thing that I'll do. But, you know, so this is still the traditional approach to. And now, and there's been really, this is a company called Cepheid, which then are doing it molecular techniques. I mean, there's no reason to do pure culture. And I was just appalled that many of our hospitals don't have it. You could tell MRSA, methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, within hours, 3-4 hours, instead of 2 days by culture, or 2 or 3 days by culture. And so that for this is certainly going to be the direction they're going, is molecular identification rather than culture. The issues, in fact, there's concern at the CDC and other places that we're going to lose all of the, people are going to stop culturing, and we're not going to have all of these wonderful bacteria that we can get. But that's a whole other thing. Then there's this whole question of species, which I won't get into. I mean, it's really philosophical more than anything else. How do you know, there was this whole attempt to sort of take bacteria, and clearly you're getting an emphasis on bacteria rather than any other microbes, and what is a species? I mean, you know, in eukaryotes, who mates with who? Well, in the case of bacteria, they mate with each other all over the place. The genes can come all over the place. So if we look at, say, E. coli K12 and E. coli 0157H7, which is the hemolytic uremic syndrome, the one that causes those nice little children, there's differences, enormous differences. That is, there are some 1,300 open reading frames that are not shared. So the raises some interesting questions about, you know, how do you define a bacterium? And so now with molecular techniques, this is the one I got the other day, if we look, you know, we used to have Shigella, E. coli. We knew Shigella was related to E. coli. When you do the phylogeny, they're all intertwined. I mean, which one is Shigella? This is the K12 group. This is Shigella. I mean, they're all over the place. So if the phylogeny isn't telling you much. There is a question of relationship. My own feeling is this is pretty boring because it's not getting at mechanisms. It's just describing it. And so we now know. So the really interesting questions come here. And a few for those of you that have not done microbiology, it's pretty straightforward. You know, we can get things. This is aerobic bacteria growing on a plate. You can easily just leave the plate out, streak some shit, whatever you want to do, and you can get colonies, and then you can take a pure culture. Once you get in colonies, colonies are products of single cells. And so this is a technique that goes all the way back to Koch. That is, we can eat, and the importance of having solid medium and getting colonies. Of course, these are bacteria that you can grow. First, they were using potato, then other kinds of, and now mostly we use agar. The rest of the thermophilic, and they use other things. And so then, the basic idea is you grow it and put it in culture, you have a pure culture, and then to estimate the densities, we do basically serial dilution, and this is the kind of thing that you would see. So we dilute so much, we get 27 colonies. You know what you've diluted by, and I'm sure you guys are going to do some of this. And you can then estimate the density of the culture in liquid. And it's what we do a lot, and I think in the long-term future, I mean, our lab, I was always thinking of, when I think of Louis Pasteur, I mean, if he came to our lab, he would feel totally comfortable and probably only impressed with all the plastic. Because much of the technology we're doing, Robert Koch would probably be impressed with the plastic. You know, that technology goes back. But now there are much better techniques, one of which is cell flow cytometry. And if you really want to estimate densities, you can under some conditions. And there's some very nice papers by Don Anderson's group and others measuring fitness differences of less than 0.01%, which is really, really hard. So, but it requires flow cytometry. There's techniques that get away from it, the classical techniques. As far as culture methods, this is from a paper by Rich Lenski's group, Jeff Barrick and Rich Lenski. If you wanted to, say, just pick up mutations, or just you could go back to single colonies and just grow cultures up. And there's a really cool study by Jeffrey Miller's group where they kept doing this and with a mutator strain, and the thing just evolved to non-growing. And so that is a good way to accumulate mutations. You just go to a single cell and everything is that. Then there's continuous culture, which is really very nice. And you get the densities are maintained at a constant level. And then there's serial passage, where you let the culture grow up and transfer. I know Rich Lenski is going to be here in a while. He's done it now for 28 years, maintaining the same culture of E. coli, watching it evolve. A tremendous resource. There's an inconvenient reality, though, that I think really maybe you guys can do more about it than we can. That is, it's really convenient to make believe bacteria just frolicking about in liquid culture, all with equal access to each other and nutrients and wastes and antibiotics. You could use ordinary differential equations and feel pretty cool about that. So it's really good for the experimentalists and good for the theoreticians to maintain this fiction. Unfortunately, that's probably a rare situation in the real world. As Paul knows, if you just leave them in a flask without shaking, all sorts of shit happens. I mean, we were trying to develop a wall-less chemostat so the bacteria wouldn't grow on the walls, but it leaked, so we couldn't figure out how to get rid of the leak. I mean, that is, any way you do an experiment, you're always going to deal with physical structure. And the really important question is, does it change anything qualitatively? That is to say, physical structure is a reality, but does it change anything qualitatively? And one answer to that question, I think Lin Chao is going to be here earlier. Part of Lin's thesis was looking at bacteriocins, which are these toxic compounds produced by bacteria that kill other bacteria. We can show both mathematically and experimentally that they can only increase when common in liquid culture. But on surfaces, in physical structure, they can increase when rare, because what they're doing is they're forming colonies, and the toxins diffusing out kills sensitive cells in the vicinity, and that's so that you get qualitatively different results when you're looking at physical structure. We have all kinds of ways of dealing with that experimentally, and we do it, and we're doing it right now. In fact, as we're talking, Waqas Chaudhry, one of my a postdoc in the lab, is now doing experiments on phage, asking these kinds of questions. Experimentally, it's easy to do. Theoretically, in terms of mathematical modeling, you're getting partial differential equations, maybe. I don't know. Is there anything better than partial or ordinary? I mean, there must be some kind of really high-quality differential equation. Just neither sound very good, partial or ordinary. But what I'm doing is raising a question that I think where the action really is. We could do these things, and we could get observations and make predictions experimentally. But without the theory, we really don't have very much. We've done some of it. Howie Weiss, one of a mathematician at Georgia Tech, we sort of asked the question about the evolution of chemotaxis. That is, chemotaxis bacteria, they have these little fimbriae and they can swim about a little bit with direction if you don't shake them too much. If you put them in a sort of very soft auger. But then chemotaxis is really a bias, so that you have a random walk. And then you get this bias random walk, which is chemotaxis. So they then go a little bit in one direction, turn to another direction. The machinery for that is separate from the machinery for the fimbriae. So we ask the question is, what about random chemotaxis? That random, does it pay just to move or does it, do you require them to know where you're going? And we used partial differential equations for that. That's one of the first papers where we actually used you could do it by various kinds of simulations and cellular automata, but can you develop some general theory? And so the answer to that one, which we published, PNAS didn't like the title, which was really an accurate one, was for bacteria, it's better not to know where you're going than not to go. Basically, we were able to show that random motion provided an advantage over non-motion, and that chemotaxis that evolved. But really, I think the best part of that paper was trying to address that question theoretically as well as experimentally. And so it's a place where I see some of the action. But remember, Louis Pasteur didn't take my recommendation about not speaking French, so you probably don't want to listen to me anyhow. Bacteriophage, I love this one. They're the most abundant organisms on Earth. People always start their papers, when they're doing this thing, the most abundant organisms on Earth. And then there's even an estimate of the number, 10 to the 31. Not quite sure whether it's 2.3 times 10 to the 31 or what, or even how they got that number. It exceeds the number of bacteria, which is interesting in its own right. But we know shit about what they're doing in the environment. We really don't. I might talk about that later. The history of bacteriophage goes back to a guy by the name of Hankin, who was the British Army in India, and he found something in the waters of the Ganges and Yuma rivers that killed Vibrio cholerae in vitro. And he also found that in these dirty, dirty waters, there was relatively few bacteria. And he found this substance that grew, that he could put through a porcelain filter, and that he could heat up. And it was almost certainly bacteriophage. We've actually worked with cholerophage. The question is, does it do anything to regulate the densities of cholera? And I can go on in that. But he impolitely published in French, so people didn't care about it. In any event, I have an English version, which I'll put onto the site. It's very, really interesting study in that he was really interested in water quality. And he came to this conclusion. As I was going through the literature, I found there was a Russian that also did the same thing a few years later. We attribute the origin to Twort and to Felix Durrell. Twort and Durrell, I think more than any other person, really was the one that focused. He was at the Pasteur, I think he's a French-Canadian, really interesting guy, adventurer and so on. And he's also the one that started the Phage Institute, the Eliava in Tbilisi, using phage. So Durrell was a real advocate of using phage for therapy. And I have these wonderful, somebody gave me his book. He wrote a book in 1926 about bacteriophage, which a wonderful phage biologist gave me a copy of. And he has these things, a cabin boy, the name of Cass, got bubonic plague, and they developed an anti-Yersinia phage, and they treated him, and they just follow his temperature, and all of a sudden he's well and lived happily ever after. And there's data and data and data after this. And so this was, you got to put this in perspective. There was no real treatment other than for syphilis, and all of a sudden phage comes out. And I also put on the site a book called Arrowsmith, which was written in 1926. It was about a young American medical student who discovers phage, and he goes to his European professor and explains to him, and his professor tells him about Durrell, and he's a little bit down. But it's a great read. It has romance in it, but it's also the most critical statement about American medicine of the time. It's on the site. I think you would enjoy it. It's by Sinclair Lewis. It has he got the work. It's a criticism of institutions. Like he goes to he was at the Rockefeller, which they call the McGurk, and he goes there. There was an outbreak of plague on some Caribbean island, and he goes there, and he's there, and the plague goes away, and he knows he didn't run the controls. He knows it's questionable, but the institute is really interested in, you know, elevating their position. It's a great read. It really is. I mean, so anyway, so Durrell was the man. Now, lytic phase, this is your sort of standard interpretation of lytic phase. There's some variations on a theme. They're mostly DNA, but not always DNA. Some are RNA, and so on. And basically, they infect the cell, they convert the cell into a machinery for producing more phage, and then we have burst. And there's some wonderful work about this. And lytic phage, so that with respect to molecular biology as we know it, in fact, there's a book called Phage and the Origins of Molecular Biology, Feshrith Padelber, who I guess was a physicist. Anyways, how important phage were to developing this. And there were basically the question about, and the most important thing, and perhaps I think the single most important experiment in evolutionary biology and in the 20th century, and arguably was this by Lurie and Delbrück. And that is the hypothesis that mutations occur only when the organism is confronted. That is, people at the time really believed bacteria could learn. That is, if I take bacteria and I put them in an environment with phage, the bacteria die off, and the next day they're resistant to the phage. You put them in an environment with some antibiotics, the next day they're resistant to the antibiotics. So, is the phage, are the phage acting as the selective generating the variation? Or does that variation exist? I mean, and so the alternative hypothesis is that the variation existed. Mutations are occurring at random. And that the natural selection is simply the editor. It's not the composer of genetic variation. Fundamentally, there's a wonderful blog by Rich Lenski that talking about why the importance of this particular experiment. Because among other things, it said bacteria have genes. That is to say, it wasn't a learning thing. So this particular experiment, and I put the original paper in that site, and I'll add more. But anyways, it was extremely important that mutations occur at random. And the idea was really very straightforward. That's Lurie and Delbrück. That is, if in fact mutations occur only after they see the environment, then you're not going to get much variation. That is, we have a whole bunch of independent cultures, let's say grow up to 10 to the 9, and then we plate, and let's say there's a 3 times 10 to the minus 9 probability of generating a mutant. You're not going to get much variation. The distribution would be Poisson. And the other hypothesis, if in fact mutations occur in these cultures before they ever saw the selective agent, we're going to get some with none, some with a few, some with many. And so the hypotheses were very clear. We'd expect a great deal of variation under one, and under the other, none, little. And when they did the experiment, this is the actual data from this 1943 paper in genetics. You think they would publish in high-impact journals. I don't know what was wrong with those guys. In any event, genetics was a pretty good journal at the time, and still is. In any event, what they very clearly show, for example, if you look here, you have 107, 0, 64, and so on. I should point out for those that are interested in the theory is not very easy. I had a wonderful collaborator, Frank Stewart, who did perhaps one of the best parts of that theory. That is, you have a distribution without a mean. Just think about that. And how you estimate mutation rates is still based on the fluctuation test. If you want to get if you want to estimate the rate of mutation, you know, if you grow a culture up to 10 to the 9 and you find 10 to the 5, 10 to the 2 cells, is that the mutation rate? No. That's the mutation frequency. How do you get the rate? And that is a lot of theory behind that. And so for those interested, I can put you on to those papers about how you actually estimate rates. The second line of evidence, and the one that the students seem to like, the first one is statistical, but the ones the students seem to like is by Lederberg and Lederberg, actually. I assume Josh Lederberg's wife, Esther, was the one that suggested, was to take velvet, a velveteen, and then take the culture of bacteria and put it onto the velveteen. So all of the cells are represented, they're basically, many of them are growing on here. So we have this massive number of cells on here. And then you have the velveteen, and then you played on to say streptomycin, and you have two outcomes. One of which is that it occurs at random. That is, the streptomycin causes the mutations, and then they would be in all kinds of positions. On the other hand, if in fact the mutants existed here, the colonies should be in the same position. And we know that, and we could go back here and find the mutant colonies. So they don't know, they may have overheard the people talking about exposing them to streptomycin, but they haven't seen the streptomycin until. So this is a very direct evidence that the mutations occur before they ever see the environment. So that natural selection in this interpretation. The question is, did these experiments really reject the alternative hypothesis? I always taught it until 1989. I was teaching it as if it rejected the alternative. Then I got a paper by a guy by the name of John Cairns to review, and he points out, he also was pointing out directed mutation and a lot of other things that caused a lot of controversy, that Luria Delbruck really didn't reject the alternative. What they did was they demonstrated that mutations occur at random. They didn't demonstrate that mutations are not also directed. It's not a really philosophical issue, it's a real issue. And the question is, how would you reject that alternative hypothesis that mutations are somewhat directed? And that's not so straightforward. And I think you might want to think about that, that is to say. And just last spring, I had a student, James Dickey, wanted to do a thesis, and we were working with staph and E. coli, and there's a drug called rifampin. It's used for tuberculosis, rifampicin. It's orange, you know. And in high enough doses, it'll turn you orange. It's an extraordinary drug. It has, for treating staph, it has an MIC, minimum inhibitory concentration of 0.05 micrograms. It would be an ideal drug. You could use it in very low concentration. And what it is, the gene for it is what is called the DNA-dependent RNA polymerase. It's the gene that transcribes DNA into messenger. A large gene called RPOB. And so I thought, here's a nice undergraduate project. That is, the reason people don't use rifampin is they say it has a very high rate of mutation. It would be a perfect drug for treating, you know, staph infections, MRSA, the strains that we have are all sensitive to rifampin. Why don't we use rifampin? And they'll tell you that, well, it has a high rate of mutation. So James estimated the mutation rate, and it is indeed high, on the order of about 5 times 10 to the minus 9, using Luria-Delbruck things. Nevertheless, in cultures of 10 to the 6 and 10 to the 7, we're getting rifampin-resistant mutants. And so there's something occurring that was inconsistent with, now I can't say directed mutation, nothing, you know, that would be terrible to even say it, but we thought, well, is the rifampin increasing the rate of mutation? Is the rifampin degenerating and so on? In this thesis, he has not answered that question. And so we're sort of left with the recognition that the mutation rate, which you would expect the likelihood of is getting a mutation rate times the total would give you the likelihood of it occurring, and it's occurring much more frequently. If somebody wants a project that I don't know the answer to, I know there's a really interesting phenomenon. I could give you James's thesis. We tried, what do you do when you run out of hypotheses? You reject all the hypotheses you've thought of, and that's it. You can't publish or anything. So there's something occurring that's interesting there. Then there's temperate bacteriophage. There's some wonderful passages. Delbruck didn't believe in lysogeny. He believed that all phage are lytic at the time in the thought. And there's this wonderful paper in 1946 where he does a review. If I give the second talk, I'll mention that, where he's trying to account for why resistance evolves and you still maintain the phage. And he doesn't want to accept the possibility that there is this phenomenon of lysogeny. Lysogeny is a situation where the genome of the phage becomes incorporated into the cell and then is transmitted vertically. So that a temperate phage can go through a lytic cycle, and then with a low probability, it can pick up the prophage, the phage, and then become vertically transmitted. So the phage genome is now transmitted as if it's part of the host chromosome, or as a plasmid for some, in case of some temperate phage. Delbruck didn't believe in this. There was a whole bunch of work on the phenomenon of lysogeny, but Delbruck was very powerful at the time and really was against that particular, that all of that it was contamination or other things. I think it's, and it's this wonderful reading this passage of this utterly brilliant biologist, well, I guess not biologist really, trying to work around how we could explain this phenomenon without allowing for lysogeny, which he didn't believe in. The answer really came from André Leveuf. Leveuf was a protozoologist involved, among other things, in demonstrating the existence of tetrahymena and so on at the Pasteur. And he decided to operate at individual cells, and because he doesn't like mathematics or statistics. He's the most wonderful. There's a paper, The Prophage and I, that I've put in that site. It's my favorite essay by Leveuf. And in fact, we were doing some mathematical modeling on the question of lysogeny, and I had a chance to meet Leveuf, although I was at the Pasteur. He was such a hero to me, I never went up to see him until we wrote this paper, the mathematical paper with Frank Stewart. And I went to see him in Paris, and he told me exactly this. He doesn't like mathematics. And so it was sort of interesting, but a tremendously important and great biologist, even though he didn't like mathematics. And so the question is, how does you actually ask whether or not phage are that there are temperate phage. And what he did was he used a bacterium called Bacillus megaterium, which he was able to manipulate with a micromanipulator. And so he let the cell, and it was thought to be lysogenic. It was thought to be carrying the prophage. So what he did was he let the cells divide, And then one cell he would put in a culture, grow it up to full density, and he shows that they're phage in this culture, that they were induced somehow. And there were no phage in around there. He did this for 19 generations, 19 transfers. And you will always find phage, so you grow this up to 10 to the 9, you always find phage there. Meaning that the phage, the genome of the phage were carried. I mean, now we would probably do it with some molecular technique, but this was an experiment that clearly demonstrated lysogeny, that there really was this phenomenon. A great experiment, and I think even convinced Silver. And you point out, there's an essay I put into there. This is Francois Jacob. He wrote an essay called The Statue Within, a book, an autobiography. In the last two chapters, he was a combat medic in World War II in North Africa, comes back wounded, disillusioned, had started medical school older than the rest of the medical students, and he ends up in Lvov's lab. It's a wonderful story of what graduate school should be. And that's, I have that chapter, the book is worth reading, but, and the other one, as are other Jacob's books. And Minot was a student of his, so Jacob and Minot, look like, are they playing cards? I don't know what they're doing. In any event, so this was a pretty good group, but I really recommend that chapter by. And the last chapter is about the lac operon, which is one of the great examples of early molecular genetics. So, and I recommend it very strongly. Now, one thing really cool is that when we look at the virulence, the first one was Cornobacterium diphtheriae. The diphtheria, and this was shown by Van Buren and Roux, that diphtheria is caused, the actual disease is caused by a toxin. So that the bacteria, that is, you can, if you cure the bacteria of the prophage, you don't get the disease. So the toxin's coded for by the phage. And so, and without the toxin, you're not getting symptoms. You're getting the, and so it raises, so, and that is E. coli 0157, cholera, all of these things are Staph aureus, we have bunches of prophage are involved in producing toxins, code for the toxins. And so without the prophage, these bacteria are nice. Well, I don't know if they're nice, but they're not. E. coli 0157 is one we've worked on. And why is it, why are these things coded for by phage? And so, and then in considering this kind of historical thing, I have this saying, bacteria may not have sex often, but when they do, it's really good evolutionarily. And that's from a paper we wrote and fortunately got past the editors. That's the opening line of a paper on the on transformation. Much of what we see in bacteria is horizontal gene transfer. That is, bacteria pretty much can get genes from anywhere. So that unlike us, where we are sort of incestuous, they can get genes from other, and they can even get genes from eukaryotes. And they have mechanisms for acquiring genes from without. And the mechanisms are threefold. Transformation is uptaking free DNA. Conjugation requires direct cell-cell contact. And transduction is mediated by phage. So that we have three basic mechanisms. And I think it's also interesting scientifically, very important scientifically. The first evidence for recombination in bacteria really was with Streptococcus pneumoniae. And it goes back to 1928, where they found that basically if we have these two smooth virulence and rough or A virulence, that is if we take the A virulent, the mice are fine, And if we take the virulent, the mice die within a little while. But if we heat kill the virulent, and then the mice, and mouse is fine alone. But if we mix them with the avirulent, then the mice die. So there was something, the phenomenon was referred to as transformation. So that basically the something in the virulent is being transmitted to the avirulent. And when they were able to show, you could do this in vitro. So this was 1928. Then these three guys, Avery, McLeod, and McCarty, Avery was working with pneumococcus. Pneumococcus was a major focus of research, more than E. coli in the 30s, in that it was a major source of mortality in the developed world. In fact, much of the death of the 1918 flu can be attributed to bacterial infections, and most of that pneumococcus. So there was a great deal of interest in pneumococcus, but Avery asked the question of what is it that's doing the transformation? So that we knew, so that you could grow up the virulent one and then extract something from it and treat the avirulent and get virulence. So something was doing the transit, and they could do it in vitro. So then they asked the question, what is it in there that is actually doing the transformation? And they did this experiment with basically enzyme. They got the enzymatically destroyed the protein, enzymatically destroyed the RNA, enzymatically destroyed the lipids. And they can enzymatically destroy everything but DNA. And that was the first direct evidence that DNA was the genetic material. A paper in 1944 coming out of this question of transforming. So, and people didn't really believe in it. And in fact, in Schrodinger's What is Life, he argues, there's a very famous physicist named Schrodinger who wrote a book, What is Life, which I think influenced many physicists, but it was wrong. Well, maybe that's why. he argued that it couldn't be DNA. It had to be, DNA didn't have the informational content. This paper, he probably didn't know about this paper, in that the perception that DNA didn't have the informational content really came from a wrong model. There was a model in the 30s making DNA this monotonous polymer. And then in the early 50s, Chargaff showed the adenine to thymine, guanine to cytosine ratio varies. So all of a sudden, we now have an informational macromolecule. People didn't believe that DNA could have had that, but this was very clearly showing that DNA was the genetic material. It's just that the theory, everything seemed wrong at the time.
Schrodinger was more right than wrong, because he predicted that there has to be an aperiodic salt.
Yes.
I just didn't know that DNA was in it.
Okay, I will give Schrodinger a copy. It's a great book, because he knows the question. And he was wrong because of biologist errors. So by the early 50s, so Watson and Crick already knew that DNA was the genetic material. There was another experiment by Hershey and Chase showing what's injected from a phage was DNA. That is, and so on. But I think by 1950, people knew DNA was the genetic material, and it was sort of obvious that getting the structure was important. And so you could, Watson's book, The Double Helix, is a great read. He comes across as a sexist asshole, but the book is a really good read, and I think for people are worth reading it, because, you could sort of see ambition and so on, and the recognition of what the really big, important question was, without any bullshit about anything else. But the first evidence came from this. And transformation is actually rather complicated. Many genes are involved. And so they're not just sort of taking up DNA. We could make them do that with electroporation, but there's a whole adaptive system of their taking up DNA. And I can rant on about that. Conjugation really led to the start of microbial genetics as we know it. That is to say, Lederberg, who was about in his early 20s, and Tatum came up with this idea of actually testing it. And what they did was they selected for strain A, which is methionine, biotin, negative threonine, leucine, and thymine positive, and strain B, methionine, biotin positive, threonine, leucine, negative. And they mixed them together, meaning they had at least two mutations. You can't get it by mutation. And they mixed them together, and then they found that, so they took these two strains and they put them together. And they got evidence for basically recombination. And then they later showed, or Davis showed, that it required physical contact between the cells. So that recombination was shown in this case. It was a great experiment, and a very simple experiment. Okay, won the Nobel Prize. And that it basically started microbial genetics, which was then the origin of molecular genetics in this experiment. And what they also were able to show later, I mean, there's some really wonderful confused papers in the 50s by Lederberg trying to figure out how this occurred, how recombination occurred. And he was sort of brought up in the Mendelian tradition with, parents contributing equally. And so he was trying to figure that out. And he was doing these crazy genetic maps. And then a guy by the name of Hayes raised the possibility that it's not equal. And, from an experiment using streptomycin, that there's a donor and a recipient. And then, in the course of time, Lederberg called the donor, he said that there is this element called the plasmid in there, and he named the idea of the plasmid. And the basic idea of what's happening is some minority of the population, this is a conjugative plasmid, meaning copies of it are transferred to other cells. The new donor is called the transconjugant. So cells can get together. We always like to make them, I think it's the conjugative pill is really an embracing organelle. We have phages that just attack through the pilus, sort of male-specific phages, and things so that the pilus is sort of bringing them together. And what Lederberg was happening, what he called F+, the ones that were fertile, were basically incorporating the plasmid, was incorporating into the chromosome, and then making the chromosome think it was a plasmid and transfer by conjugation. So that basically it was a situation where the plasmid incorporated into the chromosome and then making the chromosome into it. And that the population he was working had minorities of this, these that where it was incorporated. And later on, Cavalli and others showed that we can get what we call HFRs, which are the whole population has incorporated. And from that, we started getting the first genetic maps of E. coli, and this is a classical genetic map. And the ones that were really responsible for that were Wallman and Jacob, Jacob went back to the United States with a Waring blender, which his wife didn't think was particularly useful. And he had the idea that if they're going to conjugate, you could put them in the blender and sort of coitus interruptus at different times by turning on the blender. And so that they developed this procedure of time of entry. And that's the way people, I don't know whether you guys are going to do it here, but that's the classical way people did that. And then you do the fine structure mapping with phage. So that was done, and really very important. But it's also interesting to think about how serendipity really played a role in this. If, in fact, Lurie and Delbruck were working with a tempered phage, they would have interpreted the results, that is, the forming lysogens, tempered phage are resistant to superinfection. They might, you know, if you do this Lurie Delbruck test with, say, lambda, you're going to get the, you're going to get a very much of a Poisson distribution, not quite. So that if they, instead of working with a lytic phage, they work with a tempered phage, or, and I'm going to talk about CRISPR and restriction modification. So they were lucky. I mean, if they had the wrong phage, we would have had a very different picture about how things work. We would get the impression that the environment selects for the resistance. The other thing is, Lederberg and Tatum worked with a strain called E. coli K12, which was isolated from a patient in 1926 and was used in the lab for many years with X-rays and things like that. If they used any other E. coli, they would have gotten negative results. And we've actually, there was a paper by the Erskine, Fritz and Ida Erskine, and around 1960, they used 199 different serotypes. And when I look at that paper, the rate, they were not transmitting. And we tried ourselves. So if I could put the plasmid on E. coli B, and if I put something homologous, it can transfer. So if I make a, on the other hand, E. coli B or any other E. coli won't do that. And I once had the opportunity to ask Lederberg, had he gotten a negative result, which would have been what he would have gotten had he taken any other E. coli, ask him, how many more would he have looked at? He said one. The reason is obvious, that is, it took a lot of work to generate the mutants. So there was a certain amount of serendipity in both of these cases. That is, had they been working with tempered phage or CRISPR or something like that, very different history would have taken place. And then there's this, there's a period of, this is attributed to Minot, who I don't know had a sense of humor, but maybe he wasn't saying it funny. That is, what is true for E. coli is true for elephants, only more so. That is, in the 60s and up to the 70s, molecular biology was so focused on what we learned from E. coli. Everything, you know, we learned DNA was the genetic material, we broke the genetic code with E. coli, all of that was E. coli. And so nobody even questioned whether or not there's a different genetic code, because everybody was quite satisfied. And Brenner contributed. I mean, a very wonderful period of history. There's a book by Judson called The Eighth Day of Creation, if you really want to get a nice perspective. A very exciting period of reductionist. Now we're just sort of dealing with the shit that they didn't deal with, like phenotypic variation and so on. Now, the other thing that came out that I find kind of cool was that all these papers were being written in the United States and in France and other places in Europe, England. And the Japanese were working away. And these guys in Japan, Achiba, Kakeba, Mitsuhashi, and so on, They knew the American literature and English literature. I mean, they were reading it. And they noticed that when they took, if you have a Shigella infection and it's resistant to some bacteria, E. coli from the same host would also be resistant. Cool result. And so they had this idea of transmissible. They suggested that it was a plasmid. And they demonstrated that it was indeed a plasmid, quite independently of So they were reading that literature. So now we have transmissible drug resistance, which is a major issue in general, as you may imagine. That was done quite independently by this group, and so also first evidence for horizontal gene transfer. Then we have transduction, where a phage picks up the DNA. I think it's the shit happens. Then we have specialized transduction, that it doesn't just pick up any. Then there was evidence for transposons, that is to say, elements moving within the genome and inserting into the chromosome. And that evidence was that when lambda entered, the phage was larger. And so they knew something was funny and something entering it. I'm looking at time. So then we have this phenomenon of transposition. These elements are moving within the genome and so on. Then we have something that is utterly, utterly cool. That, well, first of all, much of antibiotic resistance are transposons carrying resistance genes moving into plasmids. And then there's this phenomenon called integrons, these elements that have the specific ability to take up genes from elsewhere. Interesting. I don't think evolutionary biologists have addressed this question very much. So the question really, what is this evolution responsible for the evolution of sex in bacteria? How did it evolve? I have opinions, but no clear answers, particularly true for transformation. How do bacteria maintain their genetic integrity? That is to say, there isn't this continuum. Why not? Why isn't there a continuum? There seems to be a genetic integrity of some sort maintained. How do the plasmids, how are they maintained? Why don't they just get rid of them? And why are genes carried on mobile elements? We've written, I don't know whether we've got the right answers, but I think they're still good questions. And why are the genes producing toxins coded for by prophage? All right. Then the innate and adaptive immune systems of bacteria. So we have phage, we have bacteria. And how do bacteria protect themselves? That's sort of a... And this is another wonderful historical thing. I'm going to run out of time. You told me people are going to interrupt, too. I think you're going to find this interesting. Does anybody know... you all know about restriction endonucleases, right? All right. You know where they came from, other than New England Biolabs. Okay, I'm going to tell that story about where they came from, and it's also a good argument for pure science, the backwater of phage biology. All right, and now you'll see a tool for capitalist molecular biologists, and you'll see what I mean by that. The phenomenon goes back to an observation by Luria in around the middle 50s, early 50s. If we grow phage on A, it gives you good plating efficiency on A and good plating efficiency on B, but poor plating efficiency on C. If we grow it on B, it gives you only pure good plating efficiency on B. If we grow it on B, and if we grow it on C, it gives you good plating efficiency on A, but not C. The interpretation was that the host that you're growing the phage on was somehow modifying the phage to enable it to grow on that type. So if I grow A and then I grow it on B, I'm going to get, it's changing somehow. So the host was modifying the phage. And these three guys, Vern Arbor, Daniel Nathans, and Hamilton Smith, really asked that question. How is this working? So we had this phenomenon of host modifying the phage in some sort of phenotypic way or genetic way. And then it was purely transmitted. And what they basically were showing was in the simplest interpretation, there are different ones, that the bacteria had ways of marking their chromosome. And that when phage came out and they were not marked accordingly, the phage DNA was chopped up by these enzymes we call restriction enzymes. So that most of the time the phage would not infect. By chance, the phage, the host modification enzymes would modify the phage DNA. They modify it, we're putting a methyl group into particular positions. And so that basically we gave the term restriction site. And what they were able to show is that there were these short palindromic sequences that when they're methylated, they would be recognized as self. And then when they're not, they would then be cut. And so there was a whole bunch of them that people found, different ones with different particular sites. Interesting evolutionarily is that there's no homology between them. That is, in the R1 and the BAMH2, they're not homologous. They're modification. So there are these two systems, restriction and modification. And from that, we got restriction endonucleases, meaning it can cut specifically. Cool observation, who cares? Well, first of all, people cared because we can now use it for fingerprinting. We could cut DNA in particular places and then ask whether or not it's the same DNA. That was one of the things, when we used to call them restriction jet maps. So you grow them up and then when they're cutting in different places. And so we could see, we could cut DNA in different ways. It's used, of course, asking whether or not a guy was the rapist or not from the DNA, and that's a little bit more complicated because we need to know particular sites, but it was using restriction endonucleases for that. And then a couple of guys, Boyer and Cohn, had this idea that is rather cool, that we could splice genes into plasmids. That is to say, we cut them with the same restriction site, and then we just mix them. And then we could form this recombinant DNA in vitro. And so this was, you know, came out of this. Here's this, we have these enzymes that cut in particular places, cut a frog DNA in that place, cut a plasmid DNA in that place, mix them together, and we're going to put the frog DNA into the plasmid and then put it into an E. coli. You can get the E. coli to hop, whatever. And so within short order, by the early 70s, they were already doing this. It was sort of, in retrospect, an obvious thing, but not really. I mean, I didn't think about it. You know, I mean, here's just what I knew about the restriction endonucleases. But, you know, all of a sudden, it totally changed. I mean, as you know, it's used for cloning everything now. And we could take, so if you wanted to make, say, insulin, you go into the pancreas, you get the DNA, the messenger RNA, make it into DNA, put it onto a plasmid, and all of a sudden you can make insulin in a bacterium. And then we could do engineering in plants. A total byproduct of basic research. And without going in, and human insulin and so on. So you could charge more money than pig insulin or whatever. And so it wasn't, there's a lot more to it. I mean, you had to get, there's more to whether something's functional. You could easily clone it, but getting it to be functional is we still don't know how to go from amino acid sequence to protein, you know, in any basic way. So anyway, so all of this occurred, and you know, we could get all sorts of things. The other thing is CRISPR-Cas. And this was really, it was first identified in 1987 as these repeats. Series of repeats. Really great for doing forensics, you know, and identifying things. And they knew that we had these repeats, and then in between we had the spacers, which were thought to be garbage. And so we got and it was given various names, and the most common one now is CRISPR. And most archaea have them, and about half the bacteria have them, in some way or other. We knew nothing about it, other than this observation made in 19. And so the question really was anything about the spaces. So there are sometimes within 500, nearly 600, up to 20 loci in a single genome with this thing called CRISPR. And the question is, what does it do? What is it all about? And they initially thought it was simply just junk DNA. And then the bioinformaticists noticed there was this relationship between the phage and plasmids in the environment that that the DNA from the phage would be the same as that in the spacer. I knew about this, but it didn't turn me on. It's a little bit of correlative bullshit at the time. But that it's working that way. And then, but who would believe that it's an immune system? I mean, even Drosophila don't have anything that sophisticated. And there were two papers written, one in 2007 and another one in 2008 by Rudolf Berenjou and Luciano Marafini. Two really wonderful, wonderful people and scientists. I mean, I'm great to... one of the joys of the profession is collaborating with people, and I collaborated with both of these guys. I mean, when I read these papers, they actually formally demonstrated experimentally that it was an adaptive immune system. Rudolf was working for a company called Danasco, which made starters for yogurt, and was working with a bacteria called Streptococcus thermophilus, which makes yogurt. And a pain in the ass to work with because of the yogurt, that is, you put it in, if you work with milk, it's favorite. And the next day you've got yogurt and you got to mix it up. And Luciano was working with Staphylococcus. The basic idea, and you probably all know about it, is the virus DNA is somehow incorporated into the spaces. It's cut out. And then, when you get infected with that virus again, it's recognized by the host, and then it would then chop it up through an RNA-mediated process, and the Cas enzyme did the cutting. And so this was done, I put on these papers. This one was actually by one of my colleagues that I just read last night, really a great review of CRISPR-Cas. If you want to get this information. Cool, so that basically it's inheritance of acquired characters. So that the phage DNA is being incorporated and then it's genetically inherited. And so, as I said, we've given Delbruck the wrong thing. I should have kept up this thing. The rate of increase in either the title of paper with CRISPR in it or just where. So we now have some nearly 7,000 papers in 2007. So this has turned into a great career opportunity, CRISPR-Cas. And I think largely, and I expect that if we're giving this talk, say, 5 years from now, many of you people wouldn't know where CRISPR came from. We'd just think of it as a tool. And this is where it came from. And the idea is that we can now use it for editing. And the idea, Luciano had a student, Wei-An Yang, who in 2011...
We should wrap up, by the way.
Okay. No, I will wrap up now. I just want to point out the student made the suggestion that we could use it for editing. And Luciano said to him, well, we don't really need it, but go ahead. And in 2013, there were these three papers. And now these people are vying for the Nobel Prize. I just want to give you the idea that it was a student that did it quite independently, Wei-An Yang. All right, I will finish here. And I'm sorry about ranting on. I didn't know exactly what you wanted and whether this was... what you want. And I'm just telling you what I find interesting. Anyways, there's all sorts of delicious questions about CRISPR, that evolutionary questions that I think are worth going after.
But I think you're going to give another lecture and more about CRISPR, right?
No, I was going to talk about why be temperate. I could talk about the CRISPR stuff,
okay,
too.
We'll negotiate.
Okay, we can talk about that. Anyways, there's some delicious evolutionary questions, and you could join the CRISPR gang. But there's some great work going on and some really major questions about CRISPR that are not answered at the molecular level.